Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Most of us have a basic understanding of interest rates, especially as they relate to our mortgages, credit cards, or student loans. But the nominal rate, as it's known, is not the whole story, not by a long shot. Joe Santos is with us today for Morning Macro. We'll take a look at the Fisher Effect, and you can follow along online on his blog, schooled.blog.com. Joe Santos is professor and coordinator of graduate programs and the Dykhouse Scholar in Money, Banking, and Regulation at the Ness School of Management and Economics at South Dakota State University. And he's joining us for Morning Macro from the Janine Basinger Studio at SDSU. Welcome. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Lori.
How are you? How was your Thanksgiving?
My Thanksgiving was wonderful. Thank you for asking.
You
and
just,
yours?
It was wonderful. Do you just study, you know, macroeconomics over turkey? Is that, I'm just curious, like what the conversation is like at the dinner table where you're seated.
It's not about macroeconomics, I assure you.
That's good. So like people were talking about Black Friday and you're like, well, actually, this is how it fits into the big picture.
No, you don't make a lot of friends doing that.
So, yeah, have another plate of turkey, Joe, and we'll get back
right.
to you. All right, so let's talk about, and let's get some definitions here about what exactly the nominal rate is, you know, as we understand it, but what is it really?
Sure. So the nominal interest rate is what we all affectionately refer to as the interest rate. It's only macroeconomics or macroeconomists who spend Thanksgiving alone who add this adjective nominal. What we are trying to emphasize, though, is the reality that the interest rate is really representing a monetary return. So very simply, it's if I were to say borrow $100 from you at 5%, that's a nominal interest rate, which means in, let's say, a year, I give you back your $100 and then I give you back $5. So it represents a monetary return, which seems perfectly reasonable, I'm sure, to everyone who's listening. Macroeconomists distinguish this nominal interest rate, our sort of go-to rate, from the real interest rate. And there what we're doing is we're considering the fact that when you lend someone money, that money tends to lose purchasing power over the time of the loan. And so often what is returned is not the nominal rate is not representing the purchasing power of what is returned. So the interest rate may be 5%, but let's just say very simply, if inflation over the course of that loan is 2%, then in terms of purchasing power, in terms of what you could actually buy with your $105, you actually only have 3% more purchasing power. So we focus on this a lot because inflation erodes that monetary return that we think of in terms of the nominal rate.
And mathematically, that must be incredibly difficult to figure out because if, you know, we just thought we don't keep track of, you know, oh, I bought a gallon of milk or, you know, with that money that, with that extra $5 that you gave me.
That's right.
When I loaned it to you, a milk cost, I mean, I wouldn't remember what milk cost
exactly.
Last year.
That's exactly right, which is why, as a practical matter, most folks, you know, could be forgiven for never thinking about this real interest rate, particularly when you're living in an economic environment where inflation is not really very high and it's right. certainly not very volatile. But to your point, yeah, in terms of calculating it, it actually is fairly straightforward. You take any nominal interest rate and what you need to subtract from that is what we think of as the expected inflation rate over the term of that loan. So again, maybe 5% is the nominal rate. We expect 2% inflation. And so we take one from the other and we get 3%. Again, 3% in terms of, as you said, how much more milk you could buy with that $105 versus the $100 that you you surrendered a year ago.
And this matters a lot for consumers who are borrowing, but also who are investing.
That's right. So if you're borrowing money, it's really the real rate that you care about. And likewise, if you're lending money, it's really the real rate that you care about, because what you're trying to do as, let's just for concreteness, think of this as, say, a lender, just one side of the transaction, you're trying to lock in purchasing power. You're actually not trying to lock in monetary returns, because you understand that the purchasing power of money changes over time. So if you're a lender, you care deeply about about real returns. So for folks out there, let's say, who are saving in very traditional forms like bank accounts and so on, if you think the rates are low now, just think about what we're talking about. When you subtract that inflation rate, then in terms of purchasing power, rates are really low right now, historically low. So most, let's say, bank deposits of various sorts, you know, you earn maybe 1 or 2%, and that matches almost one for one the inflation rate. So it beats putting it under your mattress, because then you would just lose the inflation rate as your, in terms of your purchasing power loss, but you're not earning much in terms of purchasing power over time. So as you said, for borrowers, by the way, you've probably picked this up and everyone else has too, that what's good for a lender is bad for a borrower and so on. On the borrower's side, inflation is a friend. I have to pay you back in dollars, and if the purchasing power of those dollars erodes, then I'm paying you back less in real terms. So again, I ultimately care about purchasing power, and so the real interest rate. But having said all of that, most of us just think about the nominal rate from day to day.
But I think it's fascinating as we look at these, you know, macroeconomic concepts, how often it sort of, you know, the scales fall from my eyes and I say, oh, yeah, that's why it matters to me. And that might be, you know, sometimes when people even say, well, it just feels like I can never get ahead. Some of that's just math.
Some of that's just math. Yeah. And if you're a lender, you really feel that way right now, again, because real rates are very low. Again, on the other side, though, for borrowers, it is what we would think of as a very stimulative environment. That is, again, interest rates, we've talked about this before, appear low, that is at nominal rates. Then when you subtract inflation, they're even lower still. So, yeah, we are in a very accommodative environment. That is to say, if you have an idea, something you'd like to invest in or what have you, acquiring those funds right now, you know, holding risk and so on constant, is actually quite low cost because of this low real rate.
All right. So let's talk about how what it is, those lenders, those banks, how competitive is it? I mean, because they're really in this game trying to, you know, trying to make all of this work for them.
Yeah. So it's actually competition that makes this whole effect happen. That is to say, because, let's say, lenders or banks are trying to preserve some real return on their investments, they are bidding the nominal interest rate up as much as they can in order to build in some buffer, some real return. And likewise, borrowers are well aware of this as well. And they're trying to essentially bid down the nominal rate and, if you will, squish the real rate so that their real burden is less. And it's through this competition that we know that this effect occurs, that ultimately that nominal rate is, you know, real plus inflation. So right now, banks are dealing with a very low interest rate environment. They're also then dealing with a very low real interest rate environment. So, you know, it's two sides. They are sourcing deposits and so forth at very low real rates, but they are also then using these funds in the form of car loans and mortgage loans and so on, and also earning relatively low real rates. So, as you know, we've said before, for them, it's all about that spread, the in-between, which they've managed to maintain as positive. But sure, there's no doubt both sides, as we say, of their balance sheet right now are in an environment of very low interest rates and certainly very low real interest rates.
Tell me who Irving Fisher is, because this effect that we're talking about has a name.
That's right. And so Irving Fisher is an economist whom everyone would have recognized around the 1920s and 1930s, in part because in 1929, he essentially commented on the fact that there was no depression coming. But aside from that, he did a lot of work in studying financial markets and was the first to really popularize this phenomenon, that is, noticing that credit markets quite astutely adjusted interest rates in order to, in effect, preserve, let's say, real returns. And so notice this almost one-for-one movement in nominal interest rates and expected inflation, that folks were, you know, sort of padding, if you will, the real rate in order to adjust for inflation. And though, so that's why we, you know, refer to it in the way we do. But today we think of the Fisher effect in general as just this relationship. And it's the very simple arithmetic that helps us all subtract inflation from nominal interest rates to get a sense of what we're dealing with, either as savers or as borrowers, in terms of purchasing power, of how much you're either earning if you're a lender or you're surrendering if you're a borrower.
All right. Well, why was he so wrong in 1929?
Well,
what did he not see?
He didn't see the Great Depression, right. Which, you know, he wasn't alone in
This is a sidetrack, but I have to know. I mean, like, what were the things that they weren't seeing, including him?
Sure. What I think a lot of folks did not anticipate, actually, this is quite ironic, was that what attended the Great Depression was deflation. And so if you think about that very simple arithmetic for a moment, it gets sort of mind bending when you start thinking that the purchasing power of money is actually rising over time. And so this phenomenon of a prolonged deflation was something that no one anticipated going into the early 1930s. But nevertheless, it's something that occurred. If you think of that borrower and lender relationship now, the burden of debt increases when the purchasing power of money rises, right? This is like upside down world. Mm-hmm. So now I owe you $5, and $5 a year ago meant a latte to me. And now $5 means 1 month, you know, 1 month rent. I'm exaggerating to make the point. Yeah. But as the purchasing power of money rises over time, the burden on borrowers becomes enormous. And so the inability to sustain that burden and pay back loans and so on was a kind of deterioration that Irving Fisher and many others really did not anticipate. Because again, typically we saw financial crises, we saw even severe contractions, but the kind of deflation, again, purchasing power of money rises over time, that attended the Depression was not something that anyone was, I think, fully expecting.
Yeah. So after the Great Recession, when so many people couldn't borrow, they were shocked by that. But really, that's not a surprise.
It's not. And during the Great Recession, we saw a spike. And there's an image on school where folks can take a look at this. It didn't last very long, but there was a period of expected deflation. So after, you know, a conversation we just had, you can imagine how terrifying the parallels were at that moment.
Right.
When, again, very short amount of time, but the purchasing power of money actually rose. And again, because of the Fisher effect, that means real interest rates skyrocketed for a time. And when you're in a Great Recession, the last thing you want is for the burden of credit that is servicing debt to suddenly rise. And so again, it was not long lived, thankfully, but the figures are sort of interesting. You see this jump up in the real interest rate, and that's precisely because for a time, the price level actually fell in the depths of the Great Recession.
All right, this is from school.blog.com. As of October 2019, the real interest rate over the 10-year forecast horizon was roughly 0%, revealing a relatively accommodative interest rate environment, to say the least. Unpack that for me.
Sure. So if you're a monetary policymaker, if you're the Fed, you're trying to keep interest rates very low if you believe that this economy is still recuperating from the Great Recession. And our growth, we can argue about whether it's the best we can have or not, but it has been relatively low. And so the Fed has kept interest rates low. Again, nominal, right? It's all about nominal. Until you start thinking about the inflation rate, subtract that from the nominal rate, and you realize the Fed has actually kept real interest rates exceptionally low. So there's that picture on schools where you can see since the Great Recession to until just recently, by any reasonable measure of the real interest rate, we see, as you said, a real interest rate of about zero. So a borrower surrenders no purchasing power over time when paying back a loan to a lender. So that's a very accommodative environment, and that's very deliberate on the Fed's part. In fact, if they could get that nominal rate to go even lower, they probably would have, but they've taken a policy position to not have negative nominal rates. So their only friend has been inflation, which has, if you will, technically speaking, squished the real interest rate down to about zero. And so that's been a very deliberate attempt on their part to keep credit as inexpensive, again, in real terms, as they possibly could.
So the impact on households is pretty positive, except
the impact
for the investing part of this equation.
That's right. So if it's if we're talking about savers, they're not so happy because their real return is quite low. But that's right. If you look at mortgage debt, conventional 30-year mortgage, I have there up on Schooled, the real return on that at the moment, you know, again, average loan, say 2 or 3% in real terms. So once you've adjusted for the inflation and the loss of that purchasing power of money. So, yeah, that's those low real rates have transferred from bank rates between the Fed and commercial banks to the rates that we all pay through competition. Those rates have come down as well. So, yeah, again, it's an accommodative interest rate environment, whether you're a firm or you're a household, in terms of mortgage loans and car loans and industrial loans and so on, historically speaking.
So then why are we not growing at a greater pace? Or what, you know, is that a political conversation people are having about, you know, it would seem like, but yet we hear again and again, the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. This seems like it is a specific policy to help people who are, you know, who are, don't have a ton of money to invest, who need to borrow for a variety of things. And yet
we don't see it in the numbers. That's right. So that, no, it's a really good question. In terms of the average annual growth in, let's say, real GDP, the U.S. economy has not been expanding since the recession at a rate that we would like. It's been underperforming by really maybe one whole percentage point per year. But, you know, this comes to this question of whether it's anything that monetary policy can resolve. We have this expression in monetary policy that is, it's like pushing on a string. And so you can lower interest rates, you can lower the real rate, but what happens on the other end of that string is really up to private markets and decisions, and things like uncertainty or just perceptions of risk and so forth can thwart what would otherwise be a stimulative monetary policy. So there's the big question of whether the Fed could really do anything to the long-run growth rate of the economy. Most macroeconomists would say they cannot. If you're arguing that growth rate potential is higher than what we are currently achieving, well, then you're saying the Fed maybe can stimulate our way to that higher growth rate. It doesn't appear that there's much more they can do, though, in terms of monetary policy tools, because interest rates are already so low. So it's an interesting question as to why these low rates are not as stimulative as we would expect them to be. You know, the last time they were this low and this stimulative was the great inflation, which you identified last time in the inflation chart. We don't see anything that sort of explosive in the way of growth going on right now.
Is it discouraging saving and investment? Do you think people are, regular South Dakotans have a sense that, you know, I'd rather spend this money than invest it because that seems like a little more lucrative.
Fun.
And lucrative.
This
sort of concept that you talk about in the blog about our tendency to prefer consumption now over consumption later, just as human beings.
That's right. And the way that's right. And the way we're persuaded to do otherwise is a higher real interest rate that says, you know, let me convince you to surrender that current consumption. And you're right. Right now, those rates are not high enough. And so the opportunity cost of consuming now is not very high, which may lead some folks to decide to do something other than save. But macroeconomically speaking, the issue right now is really a glut of saving, if you will. The funds are in the pipeline, so to speak, but we don't see the investment on the other end of that pipe.
Let me convince you to surrender that current consumption. I wrote that down because I just think that's a really nice way to say lots of things. Next time I'm at the store with my credit card out, I'm going to say, let me convince you to surrender that current consumption, Joe says. Joe Santos, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lori.
I'm going to put it in my wallet. I'm going to wrap a piece of paper around my credit
That's
card.
That's right.
With that
It'll help.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
And you can follow along and see all the charts and graphs and equations at schooled.blog.com. You're going to spell out the word dot for the first time and then use the period for the second one. We'll put a link up on our website as well at listen.sdpb.org.